Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. The thing I want to talk about this week is the Battle of Tsushima in 1905, and the repercussions, really, of this battle, and the argument that exists amongst many scholars of 19th and 20th century Asia, that it was the most transformative military event of the 20th century, in that it ushered in a new Asia that really was finally born after the Second World War. And in many ways, the repercussions and the implications of the battle are far more interesting to us as historians than the battle itself, though that in itself is worthy of exploration. So Tsushima was one of the first shots in the ineptly handled Russo-Japanese war. I say ineptly on the side of Russia, and expertly dispatched on the part of Japan. Tsar Nicholas II had been provoking gradually conflict with Japan over the half decade before the fighting broke out, mainly over the issue of Korea and the ever increasing Russian expansion into Asia and the Pacific. One reason for this was the inability of Russia in the 1890s to properly and confidently assert herself in the Balkans. And so nationalist and expansionist tensions within the Russian Empire were channeled eastwards, also in the hope that there would be sufficient mineral resources that would energise the Russian economy, which was slowly beginning to get to grips with the modernity and industrialization like Western Europe. This certainly, by the 1910s, is really quite an important factor within Russia. It's a kind of explosive, has a period of explosive economic growth. Anyway, it's often said that Nicholas II provoked a war with Russia to get himself out of his domestic problems. Now, if he had the guile, if you had the political nous to think of something so basic, I'd go along with that one. But I generally I don't think it's valid. I think he was reckless. I think that he stumbled into war with the Japanese. I think the Japanese gave him various outs, and he was, for the most part, an arrogant Eurocentric chauvinist. Though he himself wouldn't try not to think of himself as a European. He liked to carry on this kind of masquerade fantasy of being a medieval Russian boyar, but spoke French and was part of the kind of the grand European aristocratic network. But he like the rest of the royal and aristocratic figures of Europe, looked upon Japan as being a land of kind of yellow-skinned, servile, backward midgets. And in their ignorance, they had no understanding of everything that had occurred since the Meiji Restoration of the 1860s. Japan's rapid industrialization, her ability to take ideas and best practices from the West, and the improvement, the dramatic transition from essentially a semi-medieval army through to a modern military fighting machine. Why had Japan done this? Well, Japan had looked upon the defeat of China by the British in the 1840s and 1860s. They looked at the suppression of India from 1857 onwards and thought, probably quite wisely, that Japan was next on the list, which almost undoubtedly Japan would have been had the Meiji Restoration not dramatically changed Japan's fortunes. The Japanese were at first very dubious about contacts with Western nations, and other than Portugal and a couple of English legations, when the Americans finally arrive in Japan in order to demand that the that Japan opens up its cities to American trade in much the same way that treaty ports have been established by the British in China, there is a period of crisis. The realists and pragmatists within the emperor's government say, well, we have little other choice than to do this, whereas Japanese nationalists and traditionalists and romantics were chiefly resistant to this and terrified that Japanese culture, which has been hermetically sealed away from the rest of the world for the best part of 1,000 years, is going to be polluted by this foreign barbarism. Japan is eventually won to the side of Western and European modernization, and the results show at Tsushima. So Japan is the country in Asia in the 19th century that bucks the trend. The rest of Asia is suppressed. The French in Indochina, the British in India, Malaya and Singapore, the Dutch in the East in the Dutch Indies, and eventually at the end of the 19th century the Americans in the Philippines, not to mention the wars waged by Britain against China. And of course there's also Britain's occupation. If you go all the way as west as you can, Britain's occupation of Egypt, and the semi-colonial semi-colonial suppression of Persia in the interests of Western tobacco industries particularly. So in May 1905, the Russian fleet that had sailed from Europe under appalling conditions for the sailors had come close to mutiny on the way, was met in the Tsushima Strait close to Japan by the fleet of Admiral Togo Hiyachiro, and was sunk within a couple of hours. It was described by the Kaiser of Germany as the most important naval battle since Trafalgar, and President Theodore Roosevelt said that it was the greatest phenomenon the world had ever seen. Why did he say such a thing? Such a seemingly outlandish comment. Well, because it was the first time that Asians within the within world history had won a decisive victory over Europeans. One would probably have to go back to classical history to find an example. The battle was the end point to Russia's war with Japan. It decisively decided it, and it was really the only shooting that Russia had been able to manage in that war up until that point. It was a signal to the world that Japan had left isolation, that had emerged from its kind of self-imposed silence since the Middle Ages, and had destroyed a European power. And the modern technology like telegraph and the modern media that had connected up the world in the 19th century meant that it was not simply Europeans that got to know about this, but it was the colonial subjects of Europeans across Asia who were energized by this. And the loss of the Tsar's fleet at Tsushima was not just an issue for the Tsar, but an issue for every European power who were delighted, whose subjected peoples in Asian colonies were delighted and excited by the idea that Europeans could be taught a salutary lesson by seemingly inferior Asian peoples. Now, there is a full account of this in the very, very brilliant book From the Ruins of Empire by Pankaj Mishra. And he writes that in Calcutta, Lord Curzon, the viceroy, said that he feared that the reverberations of that victory have gone like a thunderclap through the whispering galleries of the East. What a marvellous, fascinating way of putting it, that conspiratorial types from Suez to China and revolutionaries, troublemakers and that kind of thing had taken on board this defeat by Russia as almost an omen, as a sign of Western decline. Obviously, in the eyes of many Asian revolutionaries, Japan had managed a feat that, if emulated, if repeated by India, by China, by Malaya or other places, then it would overthrow the domination by Europeans. The question was how to emulate this, how to repeat it, and in some parts of India or Persia or Malaya even, Islam was, for many nationalists, the galvanizing driving force that would unify nations and create a response to Western imperialism. Others had more secular nationalist interpretations or more secular nationalist visions of how to create independence or how to overthrow colonialism. Gandhi, who at this point was a fairly obscure lawyer in South Africa, said that so far and wide have the roots of Japanese victory spread that we cannot now visualize all the fruit it will put forth. It was one of these epoch-making moments, the likes of which, I don't know, perhaps we're living through at the moment, that it was far too early to say, even weeks or months after the battle, how much influence it would have or how far it would change the world. The only thing that most people could agree on was it would change the world at a staggering pace and that its implications would be vast. Japan was the role model for
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
For modernizers across Asia, peoples who felt that their governments, places such as the Ottoman Empire or China, had been subjugated by, you know, in their view, far weaker and less significant European powers like Britain and France, purely because the British and French had figured out the process of modernization. They had had industrial revolutions. They had developed bureaucratic, centralized states that used free enterprise, trade and commerce backed up by military force, and had colonized and used the benefits of their colonies, the economic and material benefits of their colonies, to power their own economies. These were the ideas that seemed to have won out historically by the 19th century. So figures such as Mustafa Kemal, later Kemal Ataturk, and Jawaharlal Nehru looked at the examples that Europe had shown, and instead of finding solutions in either Islam or Hinduism, they looked to instead to Japan. They said Japan is the pinnacle of Asian modernity, and that is what we must be. Turkey, the Ottoman Empire, mustn't be a backward Islamic empire built on an absolutist monarchy. Instead, if the empire is to continue, it must be modern, and perhaps even a federation in some way. Obviously, the Turkey that emerges by the 1920s is a modern nationalist secular state. Nehru says that Indian freedom and Asiatic freedom from the thraldom of Europe must emerge. And both the Japanese and Indian nationalists in the first half of the 20th century saw their own national development and their own national independence or national autonomy as being one and the same with Asian autonomy, that either India or Japan might lead the way. They might be the trailblazer for more junior partners, places such as Indochina or Malaya, to follow. And in the eyes of Nehru, a kind of modernization would be the way to achieve this. Nehru himself, by the time of Indian independence in 1947, is looking far more to the Soviet experience. Not that he himself wanted to see a Soviet-style revolution or Stalinism in India, but believed that central planning, five-year plans for industrialization, and that kind of thing would be the way in which a social democracy could be built in India. Both Nehru and Sun Yat-sen, the Chinese nationalist, were both in Great Britain when they heard the news. Nehru was a Harrovian. He was a student, a pupil at Harrow School. And Sun Yat-sen was a Chinese emigre in London at the time. And he was actually cheered by Arab workers at the Suez, who assumed he was Japanese. Now, that's a telling detail. Here we are, poor, perhaps not even particularly literate, Arab port workers on the Suez Canal, seeing Western ships sail past them day after day, really carrying the wealth of Asia to Europe. And as far as many Europeans were concerned, Suez was the gateway to Asia. These are the Arab workers that themselves cheer on the Japanese, quite what Egyptian Arabs might have in common with the Japanese is probably not a great deal. But they themselves at the time were gripped temporarily by this huge span of pan-Asian nationalism or pan-Asian solidarity. And this gives you an indication of the impact that European colonialisation had had on Asia in the 19th century and the degree to which it was resented, and that also gives you an indication of the prospects for European colonisation in the 20th century. Now, that's not to suggest that there was something inevitable about the decline of European empires. Obviously, you need two world wars and a global economic depression, the rise of superpowers, and that kind of thing to complete the picture. But it does suggest that that empires are quite fragile, and that fragility comes in large part from those that they govern. The newspapers of the Middle East, of India, of Southeast Asia are full of stories about what this implies. There are, as with all these things, moments of lurid and excitable reportage of a belief that this might spell the end for European colonisation. William Du Bois, one of the founders of the NAACP in America, said that this was a kind of a moment of a worldwide eruption of coloured pride. And again, this throws up some interesting questions. What is it that a civil rights leader in America at a time where the after effects of slavery really still haven't left the country, where despite the rights of black Americans to vote, it's still possible to be murdered in the Deep South if you do. What is it that Du Bois sees in the sinking of Russia's fleet of the coast of Japan that has a relevance and a resonance with the plight of black Americans in the Deep South? And and obviously the answer is he sees something there. He sees some kind of solidarity between the Japanese and black Americans, or Asians in general. And we probably, in the 21st century, it would be hard for us to make that connection. But he clearly does. And it also gives an indication as to the popular perceptions of colonial exploitation of Asian people. And obviously this, and the realities therein as well. And it also shows us how tuned into questions of empire black Americans were, and particularly European empire, black Americans in America were. And if you fast forward through to the 1950s, there's an immense interest by black Americans in the decline of the British Empire in and the French Empire in Africa. They see all sorts of synergies and connections, and the advance of civil rights in America is a simultaneous process. Well, Pankaj Mishra has the answer. He says that, you know, the Arab, Turkish, Persian, Vietnamese, and Indonesian and Chinese nationalists who had this range of backgrounds, range of experiences, divided by language and geography, what do they have in common? The experience of subjugation and the and subjugation really by a continent that Asia had for far, far longer viewed as being an upstart and an irrelevance, and that the lesson taught by Japan's victory was clear, that the white conquerors of the world were no longer invincible. And any empire that is now no longer invincible has a sell-by date. Gandhi, in South Africa, wrote that when everyone in Japan, rich or poor, came to believe in self-respect, the country became free. She could give Russia a slap in the face. In the same way, we must too need to feel the spirit of self-respect. And the example to countless other nationalists was that what Japan had done was something that not simply Japan's government or her navy or her industrialists had done, but it was something that had happened within Japanese people themselves. Whether this is the case is perhaps questionable, but certainly the perception to many nationalists was that some kind of consciousness had shifted throughout the amongst the Japanese people. Now, it certainly had after the victory, Japan's victory over Russia, and a sense of invincibility would have obviously interesting implications for the future. But whether Japan had really undergone this existential cultural shift is unclear. What is clear is that others, assuming this, saw that national revolutions, the overthrowing of colonialism, or in Japan's case, the threat of potential colonization, meant that some kind of rejuvenation of the people and perhaps a rediscovery of the past, of culture, of meaning prior to colonization needed to be sought. It's these sorts of ideas in Europe after the First World War that actually manifest themselves most chiefly in fascism, whereas in Asia they become parts of secular and religious national liberation movements. The first wave of change in Asia happens as a result of the belief that Japan's written constitution was the device that secured Japan her victory. Russia has a revolution fairly shortly after the defeat at Tsushima, or the unrest that Russia is experiencing morph into a full-blown revolution after Tsushima. And by October 1905, the Tsar has been forced to sign the October Manifesto, a constitution of sorts, however short-lived. By 1911, China has overthrown the Qing dynasty and created some kind of constitutional society, even though it would be racked with civil war until the mid-1930s. Similarly, a similar process had happened in the Ottoman Empire, so that the first wave of nationalist development in order to either safeguard nations and empires from European predation or to remove Europeans is the attempt to develop modern constitutional governments, be they democratic or autocratic. And I'm going to finish there. I hope you enjoyed that and found that interesting. From the Ruins of Empire is a book well worth reading. It's a fascinating read. And I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Thanks very much. All the best and bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.